JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 3, cover dated June 1991. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I am not flying solo. Every episode, we feature a different guest host, and today's guest is a longtime comic fan and podcaster who was talking superheroes on the microphone before it was cool, or at least before everyone had a podcast. About 10 years ago, he was podcasting about comics, and now he runs the JSA-focused website New Earth 2, keeping the spirit of Golden Age heroes alive and well on the internet. By day, he's an art director, and it's no surprise his love of comics helped shape his passion for drawing and art and design, and for his unwavering dedication to some of DC's most, let's be generous here and call them deep cuts, he earns our official Lone Fanboy Award for championing Jared Stevens' fate and Bloodwind. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Dave Tomko. Welcome to the JSA Embassy, Dave. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Thank you. It's great to be here. And who doesn't love Jared Stevens and Bloodwind? I thought everybody loved them.
They're so beloved that they disappeared not long after they first appeared.
Yeah. You know, Jared Stevens had two Fate series. Book of Fate and Fate, yeah. And Bloodwind had zero.
Yeah, yes.
But everyone knows him from the death of Superman, so...
That is true. He really did get a lot more exposure, quite frankly, than he deserved. I mean, I say this as a fan of the Jurgens run, and I don't want to say I'm a fan of Bloodwind, but I appreciate him a little bit, maybe, because, you know, it was the 90s. Jared Stevens, though, sorry. I've never actually read all of Fate series, so I guess I should keep my mouth shut. I'm not knowledgeable enough whether I should bash on him or not.
I mean, there's something so belovedly cheesy about his look, but you know, the story itself is the first Fate series was a solid read. I reread it actually, and I think I appreciated it, even it not just being for a nostalgic factor. It hit a lot of the same beats as the recent Khalid series that Paul Levitz did.
Oh, okay, all right. And to be fair, I'm gonna have to give it a try because sooner or later I got to do a spotlight episode on Dr. Fate. So in the 90s, Jared Stevens was a big part of it.
The Doctor was out.
Right, exactly. That original Dr. Fate miniseries, or the ongoing, I should say, the one that went, I don't know, 50, 70 issues, whatever it was. I don't remember off the top of my head. But once, and I'm totally off the bat, I don't care. Once JMD Mateus left the book, and I think it was Bill Messner Loeb's writing the book, I don't think they got very many letters submitted to him because I got published in the letters column almost every month of that Dr. Fate book.
Oh, really? I have a smattering of issues that I got out of bargain bins. I'll have to go back and check those out and try to see if I could find any of those letters.
Feel free to send those to my house with a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll be happy to, you know, autograph those and return them to you. Oh, gosh.
I'll make sure to do that.
Yeah, I bet you get right on that. Well, folks, before this gets too deep in here, and I do mean the kind you need waiters to get through, we should take a second to thank our sponsors. This episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and usually it's tied into this month's JSA issue in some way, shape, or form. Well, since this issue is all about Alan Scott, I took the low-hanging fruit. Sorry, Dave. I picked Alan Scott, the Green Lantern trade paperback, which collects the recent miniseries he had, a six-issue miniseries, plus a story from DC Pride. And it's a great story. It takes place in the 40s. It's Alan Scott as a very young Green Lantern finding his way, fighting the Red Lantern, dealing with all the issues that come with being a closeted gay man in the 40s. This thing is fantastic. It's a great miniseries. I highly recommend it to anyone that has any love for Alan Scott. It is really exceptional. And published by DC Comics, obviously. Writer is Tim Sheridan. Artist is Sion Tormey. And the cover artist is David Talaski. I probably said all of those wrong. Terribly sorry. Page count's 144 pages. It's full color. Soft cover normally goes for $16.99, but you can get it for 45% off, so it's only $9.34. Did you happen to read this Alan Scott miniseries?
I did. I mean, that was my original pick for what I was going to pick here, but I saw you grabbed it, so I knew the next one I was gonna pick was The Batman Who Laughs.
The Batman, and, let's get very specific about it. You said The Batman Who Laughs. That's not the name of the straight paperback.
Ooh, yeah, sorry. Batman, The Man Who Laughs. I'm sorry.
Well, there's a big distinction we're going to talk about in a second.
All right. So Batman, The Man Who Laughs, collects two stories. First is Batman, The Man Who Laughs. It was a prestige one-shot written by Ed Brubaker and illustrated by Doug Monkey. And it was like a spiritual successor to Batman Year One. And it retells Batman's first encounter with the Joker in modern continuity and uses the plot from the Joker's original appearance in Batman Number One.
That's cool. And Ed Brubaker and Doug Monkey? Oh my gosh, that's got to be great.
Right? And then additionally to that, they have Detective Comics number 784 through 786, which is the Made of Wood storyline, which is also written by Ed Brubaker and has art by Patrick Zercher and has great covers by Tim Sale. After discovering a corpse marked with the words Made of Wood beneath a statue of the original Green Lantern, Commissioner Gordon and Batman uncover a chilling link to a series of 1948 murders aimed at Alan Scott. And as the killings resume, Batman and Green Lantern team up for a mystery that leads through Gotham's underworld. You also get appearances from Alan's sidekick, Doibie Dickles, and other JSA villains. And the page count here is 144. It was originally $14.99, but you save 40% and get it for $8.99.
This is so exciting. Like, I had no idea these stories existed. And besides that first story sounds great, the second story with Alan Scott, I mean, Ed Brubaker and Patrick Zercher, or however you say his name, yes, please. I mean, wow, those two were amazing. And this sounds like a great story. Thank you for telling me about this. I had no idea this thing even existed.
You bet.
Well, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. This episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Firewire Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we need some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. In certain tiers, you get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks go out to this all-star squadron of supporters: Al the Comics Guy, Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Ducky, Extremely Uncanny, George Van Note, Gore Tolton, Jason Keen, Jeffrey Owens, Keechee Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Atchison, Mike Zamkowski, Roger Preeb, Little Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Gilvington, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. So, as I always say, folks, this show is about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. So please go out to the social media, find us as JSA Presents, and be involved. And the best place is going to be on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. You can leave your comments there as well. But we want you to be part of the show. So, Dave, this is your moment. This is your chance. I need to know your personal origin story with the JSA. And for a guy who runs a website called New Earth 2, this better be impressive. I'm just saying.
Well, strap in, because it's a lengthy story. So my dad was a big comics fan when he was a kid, and he held on to his collection. So when it was his turn for bedtime duty, he would read my siblings and me Silver Age issues from his collections. At the time, I don't think he realized how valuable the books he was reading were. It probably clicked later when we visited a newly opened comic shop at the time. It was owned by one of his former teachers, his high school teachers.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so then that's when the whole world of comic book stores opened up to him and to me. But yeah, those nights were filled with stories of classic Superman, Batman, Green Lantern, The Flash, The Atom, and the Justice League of America. My favorite stories were always the JLA and JSA crossovers.
Woo-hoo!
The idea of parallel worlds hooked me right away. I was fascinated by like the weird versions of familiar heroes, a Green Lantern with barely any green in his costume, a Flash with a metal plate on his head, Wildcat, who I did not appreciate at first because he felt like an off-brand Batman, but they were strange, and that is exactly what stuck with me. And, you know, after we started visiting more comic shops, I drifted towards new Superman issues, you know, like it was around the Triangle era.
Oh, yeah.
I have a younger brother, and he went right into Firestorm back issues.
A man of exquisite taste, your brother.
He was. I don't know how much he read of those. I ended up reading probably more of them than he did, but he definitely collected all of them.
I dedicated about 9 years of my life to supporting Firestorm, so he gets my vote.
Oh, you must be excited for the new series, also by JSA writer Jeff Lemire.
Nice synergy there. I know. I'm excited.
Yeah. So yeah, so then when I was 9, I had some health issues that required a bunch of trips to a children's hospital in Queens, New York. And after one of the visits, my dad and I stopped into this used bookstore we saw from where we parked. And I found a cheap run of early All-Star Squadron. It was about a year worth of like the first issues of All-Star Squadron. I felt like I was striking gold because it was a whole series built around the Earth 2 characters that I had fallen in love with, you know, back in those early days of reading the JLA and JSA crossovers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being in and out of school that year, I had a lot of time to read and reread them. And I even honed a lot of my drawing skills from those pages, looking at that Jerry Ordway art.
Oh, so good.
Yes, yes. And that was the moment my love for the JSA really locked in. From then on, you know, alongside Superman, I would grab any comic that even hinted at a JSA connection, which at the time seemed like really not many. And because of patchwork reading, I missed like some big continuity shifts. For a long time, I thought the merging of Earth 2 into the main timeline happened in Zero Hour because I had no idea the Crisis on Infinite Earths happened.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I thought Zero Hour was groundbreaking for a really long time.
I mean, it was in some ways. We got Jared Stevens.
This is true. I mean, it spawned a lot of series I love, you know, Fate, Starman, Primal Force,
Manhunter, Xenobrood.
Read all of them. I read all of them. But yeah, around then I started high school and my interest in the Superman book started to fade. He was getting into his Electric Blue phase and I was not following. And then I found a random back issue of Starman, which I hadn't read yet. And man, that book changed everything. It was a world full of those old characters, the legacy characters of the Golden Age, but it had depth and maturity that I was looking for as a reader. And I was hooked again. That run of, you know, eventually led to the JSA series, which ran for such a long time. But then the New 52 came and suddenly there was a big absence of JSA. And that gap is what pushed me to start my blog, New Earth 2. I was trying to track scattered appearances of those characters across the new DC universe, like in places like Mr. Terrific and Birds of Prey. And by coincidence, we also got a new Earth 2 book from James Robinson and Nicola Scott. It wasn't the classic JSA, but it definitely captured the spirit of the original JSA in this new modern twist. And after Robinson and Scott left the book, it really shifted directions and it felt less like the JSA and more like a Superman, Batman, alternate Earth type book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, around that same time, my son was born and, you know, the blog naturally fell to the side. And it wasn't until the new JSA that Jeff Johns did a couple years ago returned with, you know, that Green Lantern book you cited and the Flash book and the Stargirl book that I started reading again. And I came across your podcast not long after that. And then I felt that spark again to, you know, want to write about these characters. And I started the blog back up.
Wow. If we played any role, even the teeniest bit in reigniting your passion for the writing, that's awesome. Because you have an amazing site. Folks, if you haven't checked out New Earth 2, it's got so many fantastic things out there. And it really digs into where you can find all the appearances. He's been kind enough to plug our show, which by the way, bribery helps get you on this podcast. But that's exciting. That's what a great story. So, all right.
Oh, thank you.
honest, you know, all cards on the table. The Earth 2 series that you talked about, the James Robinson, Nicola Scott one. Did you, in hindsight, looking back, do you love it? Because, I mean, you put a lot of effort into it, obviously, tracking it. Or do you just kind of like it? Because I'll be honest, I'm more in the, it's okay kind of camp. And that's not to say that it's not, couldn't be good for somebody else, but that's where I fall.
Yeah, you know what? I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed how James Robinson created a world with an absence of the big three.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how the JSA worked. For the most part, outside of maybe Wonder Woman. But he even used that. And, you know, the superheroes of that world were called the Wonders. And he did a lot of things where, you know, he was losing the legacy of the JSA and their legacy characters. So he was, you know, merging a lot of the characters into one when he wrote them on this Earth. And so it was a fresh take, and it wasn't what I felt like was the JSA that I knew and loved, but it was something that I really liked and enjoyed and appreciated. And then, because everything he added had a Golden Age connection to it. And that's what I loved about it. And when Tom Taylor took over, now I want to say, Tom Taylor, I love his books. I did not love his work on JSA.
And interesting.
It was because he focused on Superman. He turned Red Tornado into Lois Lane.
Yeah, Lois Lane, right? Yeah.
And we got, he did this reveal of who was behind this door, and it ended up being Bal Zod, which ended up being a really cool character. But, you know, Zod wasn't created in the Golden Age.
Right.
So, like, I was like, Zod shouldn't be on Earth 2. It should be go dig a Golden Age character up who was a Kryptonian that you'd give this name to.
Yeah.
And so I didn't like where the focus was. And I think that a lot of people felt the same way, because eventually the story ended. But I feel like it started strong and ended not so much.
And it could have also been editorial. You know, very much at that point, DC was struggling really badly with where to go editorially. I mean, that's right before Rebirth, if I remember right. And so they were trying to figure out what to do. And so it could very well be that editorial said, you got to make this a Superman and Batman book somehow. You know, it could have been that too. Because I'm also a big fan of Tom Taylor. Tom Taylor's Nightwing and Titans and, I mean, so many other books are just exceptional. What a great writer.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. I agree so much. Yes. I love almost everything I've read from him, except for that.
Ironically, right?
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, I agree with you that it could be editorial. But I have been thinking about going back and rereading them, seeing how much I like them now and how much they stand up. And if my memory of how things were in the past lines up with me reading them now.
Sure. And a lot of times it's easier to read something after it's over, because you know, like, okay, I know where this is going to end, and I don't have to worry month to month anymore. You know, if this is a book I still want to collect, it's like, okay, it's a finite story now. I know where it's going to go. And sometimes you can enjoy it more.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Well, why don't we get into our discussion topic? You know, in this issue, Alan Scott has to step in to his role as a television station manager. And that got me thinking about different secret identities the different JSA characters have. And so Dave and I talked, we thought it'd be kind of a fun idea to talk about everyone's secret identities and then figure out who we think has the coolest secret identities, or at least careers in their secret identity. So what I did was I pulled a lot of this information, mostly from Who's Who. I mean, it's kind of where I live and breathe is Who's Who. Did a little quick internet research, so I could have certainly missed some information here. So don't come at me, bro. Here we go. So, and I'm going to do these kind of in clusters. Like, for example, Carter Hall, right? Hawkman. He was an archaeologist. Well, so was Ken Nelson, you know, Dr. Fate. So what do you think about their careers as archaeologists in those roles?
I think they were great for those times. And I feel like there's not a lot of archaeologists that I know in the world, but I feel like the JSA has most of them.
JSA and Doctor Who seem to have a large number of archaeologists. That is true. And my memory is, like, I remember Carter Hall doing things that archaeologists do. Kent Nelson, I remember him reading books, like doing research.
Yeah. I mean, and wasn't he, I'm using my old man brain now,
sure.
But wasn't he like a kid and his dad was the archaeologist, and then he got lost in the tomb, and then he spent years under tutelage from, his name?
Naboo,
thank you. And then, you know, he came back out like 2 seconds later and his dad was dead and he was fully grown and now he's an archaeologist. So he had a weird a weird path to becoming an archaeologist, and I don't think he does much of archaeologing.
Yeah, I think that's the verb, right?
Yeah,
I mean, he's constantly surrounded by really cool like Egyptian iconography and stuff. But yeah, I don't see him in the ground with a trowel and a brush. So yeah,
definitely not.
All right, well, let's move on to our scientists, which are going to be like Rex Tyler, our man, who's a chemist and a scientist. We've got Jay Garrick, the Flash, who's a research scientist, and then we've got Al Pratt, the Adam, who starts off as a college student because he was like the kid, but later he becomes a college professor of nuclear physics, which just, it blows me away that that's what Al Pratt's doing. Little Al Pratt's a professor of that topic. But either way, so where do we fall on these guys?
I mean, I feel like these guys are the best a superhero could be, because when I was a kid, I wanted to be a scientist. Only because I was praying for an accident to happen to give me superpowers.
You're like standing out there with a lightning rod.
Yeah, exactly. Can someone throw some hard water on me?
I need to breathe some fumes, please.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that is too funny. That is too funny. Like, I remember Rex, like, and maybe this is more of 90s and 2000s. Like, I remember him always in a lab. So, like, that's cool. I dig our man, you know, making the Miraculo, all that stuff. Totally there. Jay Garrick, research scientist. I guess. Like, I remember sometimes him doing sitting at a desk or something. But most of the time, he's either saving the day or, you know, flirting with Joan, which who can blame him? And Al Pratt, I didn't really stick with Infinity Inc., so I didn't really see him as that professor, but I'm sure it's in there somewhere.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, I mean, I feel like I saw Ted Knight, who's like an astronomer slash scientist, doing more sciencey stuff in the Starman 90s series than a lot of these guys.
That's fair. Very fair. Well, why don't we jump to that group since you just mentioned them? So let's do Wesley Dodds, the Sandman, who his job, according to Who's Who, his job is wealthy socialite. Which is, that's a pretty good gig if he can get it, I guess. Then Ted Knight, Starman, is millionaire and amateur astronomer, as you mentioned. And yeah, he did a lot more science too.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I would even say in this recent like Sandman series that came out about Wesley Dodds, they had him as an inventor of, you know, his gas gun. And he had contracts with the military that a mystery was wrapped up in.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I feel like they both did, you know, those types of things, you know, where they were like, we're kind of inventors. You know, they're like, we're socialites, but we're also kind of doing stuff.
Well, I guess when you're rich, you can afford to piddle around and pay attention to science all day and not have to, you know, do the 9-to-5 grind.
Right, right. You know who was a really, really, you know, a Nepo baby, I guess, as they would call it nowadays, is Sylvester Pemberton.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, you're right. Because he had him in, yeah, he had a bodyguard and all this stuff. You're absolutely right.
He inherited with Stellar Studios, right, from his parent.
Good gig if he can get it, I guess. him and his aunt, Mary of a Thousand Gimmicks or whatever it was, I think.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Jeez, nepos. Okay, then we've got a wide variety of other jobs, but I'm for people, and I'm just going to kind of break them down into clusters so they're easier to talk about. So, of course, we have Alan Scott, Green Lantern, who's our guy this issue. He was an engineer for trains and then radio stations, and then later he went on to be the manager and owner of radio stations and then TV stations. And then we'll pair him with, why not, Jim Corrigan, the Spectre, who was a police detective. You know, he was very much the gumshoe, you know, rough, hard-edged cop kind of thing.
Yes, I loved Alan Scott's career because he's, you know, an engineer for trains. And in that recent book, they showed he was also an engineer for the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. And then he takes that over to radio, which he used to find out all the crimes that were going on so he could stop them. But in those old stories, he often was shown as like a jack of all trades at the radio station. So he was, you know, sometimes he was on air talent, you know, sometimes he was fixing things, you know, all these types of things. So he's one of my favorites as far as careers.
And I'm a little biased because my dad, when I was growing up, managed TV stations. So, oh, wow. And so that he was the general manager of a TV station, a lot like what Alan has to do here. My dad used to have to do, used to have to go on the air and say, you know, hi, blah, 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 blah. And so I'm a little biased there. I would also say that if you think about the traditional superhero angle, like Superman and Spider-Man, let's just say, they're both associated with a news agency so they can stay on top of whatever emergencies are happening. And out of everyone on this list, every JSA member, Alan's really the only one that through his job, he could potentially keep his finger on the pulse of the news, really. So it's pretty clever.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. Especially of these old, you know, JSA original guys.
Exactly. Let's see. All right. We'll talk about Johnny Thunder. Why not? So who's who had some fun here? They list his career as various, and then it includes window washer, world heavyweight boxing champion, G-man, rodeo rider, U.S. naval seaman, king of Badnesia, etc. I absolutely love that someone spent the time to crawl through all those golden age stories of Johnny Thunder and look at some of the ridiculous careers he's had. That cracked me up.
Yes, I read that one of the running gags was he couldn't keep a job. That's why he had all those jobs until he became king of Badnesia, which, you know, puts him in running with Queen Hippolyta for, you know, another monarch of the JSA.
I guess so. They're on a little bit different level, I think. But
yeah.
And I wonder what Ted Grant would say about Johnny Thunder claiming to be the world heavyweight boxing champion. So I feel like there's a story there waiting to happen. So.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to see that one panel story.
Totally. Okay, so then we'll knock out these last four. Charles McKnighter was Dr. Midnight. He's a physician and later an author. We've got Terry Sloan, who's Mr. Terrific, who was a businessman and a teacher. Then we've got Ted Grant, Wildcat, who was a professional boxer and later owner of a gymnasium. And Dinah Drake, Black Canary, who was a florist. So, you know, Charles McKnighter, as a physician, I do feel like we got to see him a lot in that role, at least through the 90s or flashback stories. I feel like he did play the physician role a lot. The other ones, I guess Ted with the boxing, but I don't know about the rest.
Yeah, I had to look up what Terry Sloan did because I was like, I feel like he was a businessman, but then I thought maybe he was like a philanthropist, and I was kind of putting him in that like Wesley Dodds, Ted Knight category.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was like, oh, businessman. Well, that's pretty generic.
Yeah, you know, who's who didn't say it, but wasn't he supposed to be super rich or something too? Because he was just, he was bored.
So.
He was bored in life. Yeah.
Yeah. That was part of his like origin, I think.
Yeah.
And now I have to go back and reread it.
Well, and then Ted Grant, obviously professional boxer, later owner of a gymnasium. So we did get to see a lot of, especially in the 90s, they really did lean into that when Ted got to do quite a bit. And then out of everybody, I'd say Dinah Drake as florist is probably the most realistic of everyone's secret identity because, you know, archaeologists and physicians and, you know, millionaires, all these highfalutin jobs. And then, but you know what? The world is really made up of people that work the 9-to-5, that doing a job that, you know, it's doing some good, but it's not changing the world. And that's what a florist does. It's a good job. It helps people, but you're not, you know, one of the top, you're not a one percenter. And so that's probably one of the more realistic jobs for a superhero, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like we saw a decent amount of that in the like 90s Green Arrow series, the 80s, 90s Green Arrow series by Mike Grell, the Sherwood Florist, I think it was.
Right. I think that's right. Owned.
And yeah, that is definitely like one of the most like realistic jobs. I did go back and look up what Ma Hunkel did because I was like,
Good call.
Did she ever have a job or was she just, you know, stay at home mom? And she ran a grocery store, which I feel like fits like right in with this florist, like, you know, 9-to-5 real job.
Totally. I'm glad you added that one. That's fantastic. I love that. And you're right. That's exactly the kind of career regular people have.
Yeah.
All right. Now we have to make the painful decision of who's got the coolest job. I'll be a jerk and make you pick first.
Well, I mean, I think I kind of showed my hand a little bit earlier talking about how much I loved how Alan transitioned his engineering skills from army to trains to radio. And so I'm going to go with Alan. You know, I mean, this is his episode after all.
And that's actually who my pick is as well. And I've already, yeah, I showed my hand too. Obviously, I showed my own personal bias and things like that. Now, my second choice has got to just be Johnny Thunder because all of his insane insane careers. I just love that. I would love to see those kind of stories told from a modern perspective, but, you know, still tongue-in-cheek, having fun with it. I think that would be a hoot to see some of that. But, folks, what about you at home? Who had the coolest career? And who are we forgetting? You know, like, jump forward, you know, bring in some of the Infinity Inkers or maybe some of the Super Squad or the JSA from the 2000s. You know, who has the coolest career? Let us know. Write that in the comments. I want to hear from you, folks, because, again, it's a collective conversation. It's not just between Dave and I. Now, Dave, we've been dancing around it. We got a comic to talk about. You ready to do this?
Oh, yeah.
All right, folks. We are going to talk about Justice Society of America, issue number 3. And if you want to see some pages from this issue, you can go onto our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll post just a few of the pages there so you can see what we're talking about. But this is published by DC Comics. Cover date is June 1991. It was on the shelves April 16th, 1991. Cover price was $1 for shiny quarters. And the cover is by Tom Lyle. You want to describe it for us, Dave?
Sure. All right, so the cover for Justice Society of America number 3, like the rest of the series, was illustrated by Tom Lyle, who I'd say was most famous for co-creating Will Payton's Starman and Stephanie Brown, the Spoiler.
Woohoo!
He delivers a dynamic composition that leans heavily on dramatic perspective and classic superhero iconography. Alan Scott, the Golden Age Green Lantern, is caught mid-flight or mid-fall, depending on how you read the angle. His cape creates a wide arc that nearly frames the entire scene. Opposing him is the latest Golden Age constellation being, Sagittarius, who gives me really strong Marvel's Longshot vibes.
I see that. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Lyle mirrors the composition between, you know, the two figures, exaggerating the arc of Sagittarius's legs to echo the sweeping curve of Alan's cape. So it all focuses on the real star of the cover, and that is the city itself. The exaggerated perspective of the art, the deco-inspired skyscrapers, combined with the circular composition of these figures that I was talking about, creates a real sense of motion and almost vertigo. You know, Lyle contrasts the dense detail and crosshatching in the buildings with a cleaner, simpler rendering of Alan that makes it clear where the visual weight lies and where the viewer's eyes are meant to go and where he most likely spent most of his time on this cover.
I tell you what, going forward, I am going to pay the designer to artistic designer to describe the covers, because you wow. I mean, you really created a mind picture of what this thing looks like. That was really impressive, sir.
Thank you.
For me, like, you know, it's got the same trade dress as the previous issues, and dang, I love that logo, that Justice Society of America logo. I think it's gorgeous, and I love the corner box with the heads. It's so Marvel, but DC's playing around with it. It brings me a lot of excitement, but I gotta say, as much as I love the cover, and I'll talk more about the body of it in a minute, but the top half, there is a lot of colors going on here in the top half of the comic. And I only realized because, like, the way we have our Google document laid out, I was writing and I could only see the top half of the comic, and it really forced me to pay attention to it. And you've got so many colors. You've got the blue DC Bullet. Each hero has their own colors in the corner box. You've got this yellow and orange, part 3 of 8. Then there's a yellow and burnt orange for the JSA logo, and there's different shades of yellow and green for the shout out box about Green Lantern. So even without the image that you described, just looking at all the trade dress stuff, you have blue, two different shades of orange, two different shades of yellow, plus green and red and purple and blue silver and skin tone. I mean, again, I love the cover, but the top half is, now I realize, way too busy, way too busy.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I was wondering, when I look at Lyle's drawing here on the upper right, he just stops up there.
Yep.
And I wonder, I was like, did he erase that? Was that erased? Because of all that was going on the top, like you're talking about? Or was he just, you know, exhausted from how much time he was spending on this city?
Could be a little column A, a little column B.
But yeah.
So this is issue 3. So it may have been that he, because, you know, they have to draw the covers kind of far in advance, that he drew issue, like, by the time issue 3, he was drawing that. Maybe issue 1 had hit the stands or something, or maybe he had seen the how it was going to be laid out, and he's like, oh, why even bother drawing anything at the top? It's not going to show. So looking at Sagittarius, a couple different things there. I love the blacks. I love the shadowing. I love the space speckles kind of going on, almost like Kirby dots. I just think that looks really fantastic. And it wasn't until this moment I realized, like, the sort of asymmetrical design thing he's going for. Like, one leg has, like, the pirate bucket boot, and the other leg doesn't. And, you know, there's also, like, some straps on the legs there. So he's really trying to Oh, he has a shoulder pad on one shoulder, not the other. So he's really kind of trying to do an asymmetrical look here going on with the costume, which is sort of interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very 90s thing to do.
Probably why I like it. And then Tom Lyle. I say it every episode, but what an amazing art talent. You mentioned Will Payton, Starman, and Spoiler. Both of those are two of my favorite characters. I just love his work here. And he really does physique really, really well. And the both characters look very physically fit. They look fantastic. I did find one little tiny physique thing that made me scratch my head. Like, what exactly is going on with Alan Scott's right knee? It looks painful, whatever it is. But that aside, it's amazing, right? And you were and you're right about the cityscape. The skyline is absolutely the biggest feature. And though and I think what the colorists probably had to do when they got this, they're like, oh man, what am I going to do? How am I going to not overwhelm the superheroes with so much detail? And so I think that's probably why the colorist used very muted colors for the background. Now, I mean, they did color each building his own color, which is nice. But you notice those are all very muted to try and make Alan pop off the page, which he does. I mean, that red and that green are really striking, so he does pop off the page.
Right. I mean, when you have a cover with Alan Scott, you already have like five colors on your cover right away. So, yeah. You know, you should just start stripping the rest of your colors away.
Yeah, true. So as an artistic designer, do you give this cover a thumbs up, thumbs down, somewhere in the middle? What do you think?
I love what Lyle was doing here. You know, like I said, the sense of motion, the vertigo, the detail of the skyscrapers. But like you said, the trade dress, the coloring, it's a little all over the place. So I'd give it a middle, you know, in the middle. I'd say it's in the middle. It's good, but, you know, there's some work that could be done on it.
Yeah, I'm there with you. And I bet you if somebody somewhere owns the original art for this, and it would be without the trade dress, and I bet you that looks beautiful. Just seeing the Tom Lyle's art in black and white without everything. Yeah, so... Well, let's get inside. So the writer is Len Strzuski, who we know from this series and our previous JSA series. And the artist inside, folks, it's Mike Parabek. Woohoo! So lovely to see him again. You know, we covered the 1992 series, which takes place after this, in reality, when it was published. But it's nice to see Mike Parabek working on JSA characters. Inker is Rick Burchett. Letterer is Janice Chiang. Colorist is Tom Zucco. And the editor is Brian Augustine and Mike Gold. You want to start us off with a recap?
Sure thing. The opening splash page gives us the punny and foreshadowing title, Vengeance of the Stars, Chapter 3, Dead Air. Alan Scott, now the vice president and general manager of Gotham Broadcasting Company, steps in front of the camera for a live report on Gotham's blackouts, echoing his golden age days of jack-of-all-trades radio man. As he reassures the viewers, the power abruptly cuts out, revealing that this scene is the same scene we saw in the storefront TVs in the first page of the previous issue.
Oh, wow. That's clever.
Yeah. True to form, Alan reacts like a jerk, throwing paper and snapping at his staff when the outage persists despite backup generators. The problem, they explain, is not a failure, but something actively draining the power. When a strange light floods the studio, it's clear the source is external. Outside hovers Sagittarius, a glowing celestial being, silently absorbing energy from the city and GBC itself. Alan retreats to his office, recites his oath, and transforms into Green Lantern. Confronting the being, he finds it in a sleep-like state with its eyes closed as a star-like energy pulses within. Naturally, Alan chooses the direct approach and attacks with a cup of hot coffee, provoking the entity into retaliation. The clash reveals two key truths. The being can be harmed, but it's composed almost entirely of energy, making it a dangerous opponent. The issue then cuts to a recap where we left Black Canary, Solomon Grundy, and Vandal Savage's thugs from last issue. Grundy, spotting Green Lantern mid-battle, abandons his fight with Canary to pursue Lantern. Canary pursues Grundy, but is knocked unconscious and kidnapped by the thugs. As a GBC news crew obliviously films Green Lantern battling Sagittarius, the real danger unfolds in the background, with Canary being carried away unnoticed as Grundy barrels through the crew.
So I'll take it from here. The lead henchman calls to provide a status update to Vandal Savage, though I didn't really realize long-distance calls from a payphone were that easy back in the 1950s. Like, how many dimes did that cost to call, what was it, like New Mexico or something? Anyway, everything's going according to Savage's evil plan. The evil henchmen report that the Egyptian artifacts are secured, and they've even managed to capture Black Canary along the way. So if you're an immortal conqueror, that's what you call a pretty productive afternoon. Savage, clearly enjoying himself, is watching the action live on GBC, which he's allowed to broadcast just for his enjoyment. His focus is on Green Lantern, currently battling Sagittarius. Savage gives the order that once Green Lantern goes down, he should be brought in too. He's collecting superheroes like trophies at this point. He then turns to Ted Knight and explains the bigger picture. According to Savage, modern technology is the only reason he lost World War II, so his solution is simple, in a complicated way. He has summoned constellation beings to absorb the energy of modern technology, like electricity and radio, effectively rolling the world back to a simpler time, a time where, coincidentally, he would have the upper hand. Meanwhile, the fight's not going quietly. Green Lantern is holding his own as Sagittarius transforms into a giant eagle. The battle wrecks this GBC camera equipment and the transmitter tower, but Lantern manages to cage the creature for a moment. Then Solomon Grundy shows up and immediately escalates things by throwing a telephone booth at Green Lantern, which just happens to be made of wood. So obviously it works, and Lantern is knocked out cold. Sagittarius the Eagle breaks free, and in one smooth move, scoops up Green Lantern, Black Canary, and presumably the artifacts before flying off. And Solomon Grundy is left behind in Gotham, having his worst day because he didn't get to kill Green Lantern. Next issue, Hawkman! So there we go. Lot to take in here. So overall, big picture, like, what'd you think of the issue?
I loved it. I loved how it was lining up with the issue before, and it dropped in little spots where we could see how it lined up with the past issue.
I totally didn't hear that or see that, I mean, until your recap. Like, I was actually wondering, because there's like one page that is essentially a word-for-word replication of the previous issue, like where Black Canary is dragged away or and fights Solomon Grundy. And I thought, why are we seeing the exact same page again? And I thought, would it make more sense to have a full recap than just one page? But you're right. Once you pointed out that, yeah, you get that, but you on the flip side, you get Alan on TV, I was like, oh, wow, that's actually really clever the way he's threading all this together.
Yeah, it's great storytelling because it doesn't feel like recaps. You know, that's the best way that these old books are written from the 90s and before, where you're catching up the reader as you're going. And, you know, the reader who read it last month doesn't feel like they're getting the same story again.
Right. I mean, by comparison, we read some last month, we read some John Byrne 1990s comics. And man, you would get two or three pages of recap and it was a struggle. This, you're right. This was a lot more organic. So good point. Good point.
Yes.
So getting into this, so like pages 1-3, you're getting Alan Scott in the GBC studio, and man, Parabek can really draw men in suits in the 1940s. I mean, they look so good. These news guys, I mean, some of them are overweight, some of them are skinny, some are wearing hats, some are wearing ties. It just, they look fantastic. They look like the way you want guys to look in the 1940s. And on page 3, there's this one shot, the last panel, where three of the guys, Alan and two of his workers, are leaning out the window to look up at the constellation, and they just have these look of shock and awe on their face as they're seeing Sagittarius for the first time. It just looks great. And the coloring too, the lighting in this first few pages of the electricity's out. It's just, this is really exceptional stuff.
Oh yeah. I mean, when you said all the different types of characters and, you know, the different suits, how they looked, I immediately thought of that panel. I think that shows Parabek at his finest. And, you know, this is the type of stuff that I loved when I read his stuff in the animated series Batman, the animated series comic. He's just so great at this stuff. And, you know, obviously that comic had that same Art Deco type style, that same mid-century look of characters. And he's a master at it.
And this is before Batman, the animated series even starts. So Parabek is finding the style on his own. It's not like he's being inspired by the animated series. So I just think it's so cool. It just looks so stinking good. Then we get into the full page splash as the reveal of Sagittarius. And we only see him from the side. So we don't actually even see his whole costume. We just see him floating in the air. Honestly, he looks like a hippie with like the long hair and all that. And like, you know, I'm expecting him to say peace and love. And he's floating in front of the GBC building. And then the next page, you get five panels leading to Alan's transformation of Green Lantern. If I had had my way, I probably would have flipped that and given Sagittarius a little bit smaller of a reveal and give Alan a full page for that transformation, because the oath is so cool. Seeing Parabek draw Alan Scott in his prime and that young. And if you think about it, at this point, this is, what, 1991? They hadn't even really seen the JSA since 1986. So it's been 5 years since any of the JSA have even appeared really in a comic for the most part. So a big reveal of Alan Scott would have really been a wow factor on the page. My thoughts.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. That was one of my favorite spots in the whole comic, was just seeing Alan recite the classic Green Lantern oath and turning into Green Lantern. There's not much better you could get for an opening scene after not seeing that guy for a few years.
Yeah. Now, folks, the oath specifically here is, and this is quoting, "And I shall shed my light over dark evil, for the dark things cannot stand the light of Green Lantern." And I did a little research on it, and I guess I didn't realize this, but Alan apparently had a whole bunch of different oaths over the years. And this is just one of them. I'm not sure if this is the first one he had or not. I don't know. But this one did become sort of the standard for the 1990s and on, because obviously it's different from Hal. They don't want Hal's and him to have the same oath. And I believe Hal's oath was actually one of Alan's beforehand. So I don't, you might be, I don't know. I'm putting you on the spot here. You may be a little more informed than me. Do you know a lot about Alan's oaths?
I have read, like you, some different versions of the oath, and they're all, you know, slightly different and poetic in their own ways, but this is the main oath I know as well. You know, the one that popularized in the 90s from what he has used, and I use the word popularized loosely because most people only know, you know, Hal's oath.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, folks, if you people at home know the whole ins and outs of Alan's oath, feel free to share. I mean, I'm not asking for a dissertation, but I'm just saying, if you know a little bit about Alan's oath, feel free to share. One of the things I noticed is Alan, whenever he uses his ring, he always refers to it as his power beam. So I'm assuming that's probably what Alan said in the Golden Age. I don't know for sure, but it felt nice because he wasn't saying, you know, his power ring or anything like that. Just power beams felt very retro to me.
Yes, definitely very, very retro. And I really feel that this story got Alan Scott's character really consistent and really right with his past portrayals of him being an insensitive jerk. I mean, he like flips out on his employees. He's not really understanding about these power outages. He's throwing papers all over the place, which, I mean, do you think he gets a lot of paper cuts because of his weakness to wood?
I bet he does. I bet that ring can't protect him from a random sheet of paper. Oh my gosh.
So I'd like that for me to be a running gag of, you know, him working at GBC is always getting paper cuts.
He was probably so excited when the digital age came. So I got questions here. Okay, so because you know a lot more. I'm going to give you the label of more of a historian than me. Let's put it that way. So I've seen Alan go off the handle a couple times. Like I remember in the 92 JSA series, like when Kulak is feeding all that misinformation on his own TV station, he gets so mad he like destroys his TV or something. Like that was surprising to me that he went off the handle. But is there a history of Alan being a jerk like this?
Yeah, you know, specifically from what I remember in the 90s, he was a real jerk to any of the up and coming heroes, you know, like Fate. I remember him kind of being a jerk to Damage. I kind of remember him being a jerk to so many people, even Obsidian in a way, you know. Yeah. I feel like he was not someone who was a caring and emotionally open person. He was always closed and stern and Batman-like. Maybe being from Gotham City, writers, you know, wrote him that way, but you know, it doesn't hit the same with his parents not dying in an alley, you know?
Everyone from Gotham is a jerk.
Exactly. And I think, you know, with this new JSA Year One story, I think they are kind of using that same sternness, that same, he's really pushing people back, but looking at it from a new light in his being closeted gay man and being worried about how he's acting and stuff like that. So it brings a new layer to him being an insensitive jerk that I really like.
Interesting. Okay. Well, hey, folks, if you remember other instances of Alan being a jerk, let us know, because this is an interesting pattern I'm seeing emerging here. And I think in this 2000 series, he was a lot more shepherding. I think he was much more warm during the Geoff Johns run, but that could have just been Johns' interpretation. And I know Judd Winnick also wrote Alan Scott to be in the Green Lantern book. Like, he would show up every once in a while in Kyle Rayner's run. And Alan was a lot more supportive in that run too. But maybe that's a deviation from what we were seeing in the other books. Interesting, huh?
Yeah, and you know what? In my head, I remember him kind of being a jerk to Kyle. Now I want to go back and reread those books, because those, you know, when you said that, I was like, oh yeah, I don't remember him being like super supportive, but he did give him his ring at the end of Zero Hour.
Well, it all depends. Like, the early, like, Ron Mars wrote a Hero Quest story where Alan was totally a jerk to Kyle. I only know this because I read a bunch of Kyle books for a podcast a while ago. So he was a jerk to Kyle, but then in Judd Winnick's run, he made a lot more supportive. At the same time, Kyle was sleeping with Alan Scott's daughter. I mean, if that was me, I wouldn't be very nice to him at that point, but something else in here too, I noticed Alan's cracking a lot of jokes in this issue here, sort of similar like Black Canary was last issue. So this is clearly retconning a little more banter in the Golden Age heroes, but that's to be expected, because I mean, people back in the 40s, they were funny too. They just didn't write the comics that way.
This is true. The other thing that I noticed here with Alan was he was really the aggressor in the fight here. You know, after he yells at his employees and he looks out the window and sees Sagittarius, and he goes out and it's this big glowing sleeping being emanating light, sucking power from his station, and he's ready to attack. He's ready to go to straight hot cup of coffee and a punch.
Well, I'm gonna disagree with you a little bit here. I don't see him as the aggressor, because, you know, Sagittarius is up there soaking in all this energy. And Alan does create the cup of steaming coffee, but he doesn't use it to attack with. He just, like, sticks it under Sagittarius's nose to wake him up. Like, the aroma is supposed to, like an energy being is going to care about an energy cup of coffee. But whatever. You know, the joke is there that coffee is going to wake him up. And Alan doesn't attack until Sagittarius, like, crushes the transmitter or the station. That's when he finally attacks. So I do feel like the Sagittarius is the one who instigates this. That's just my two cents.
Yeah, I don't know. If someone woke me up with a cup of coffee right under my nose, I think I'd be a little annoyed.
Clearly Sagittarius was, so okay, yeah. This also reveals something that I gotta say. So in here, Alan says, quote, "We can't have our viewers missing Sid Caesar, can we?" And he's talking about the way the Constellation is destroying the transmitter. So being the TV station nerd that I was, I had to do some research here. If they're talking about Sid Caesar being broadcast on this network, that tells us that GBC is an NBC affiliate at this time in 1950 or whatever. Because Your Show of Shows, which was a Sid Caesar show, was on the air from 1950 to 1954 on NBC. So there we go. That is apparently important to me. Because I'm a big old nerd. And actually, jumping forward, there's actually a reference later, another TV reference, where the outraged TV producer refers to Murrow, M-U-R-R-O, and kids nowadays probably have no idea who he was. I barely remembered and had to even do a little more research, but that's Edward R. Murrow, who was also a CBS and was one of the most famous and respected newsmen of that era.
Yes, I got the Murrow reference, and I knew who Sid Caesar was, but I did go back, and then for both of those, I went in and punched in Google to see if they were working at this time point, if the writer got it right, and he definitely did.
Yep, he knew what he was doing. Yep, sure did. Let's see. Then you mentioned the punch. So yeah, there's a bit here where on page 9 and 10, where the cameraman says, "Green Lantern's making something weird out of his beam." And it turns out to be a boxing glove. And you get this great splash page of this boxing glove punch that just slams into Sagittarius. It looks fantastic. It's a great full page. Again, Parabik went insane, sort of like Lyle did on the cover, with detail of the cityscape. I mean, it's just stunning, the cityscape that you see here. I'm sure the inker was really pissed when he saw that page come across desk, but it looks great and the punch looks fantastic. But my only question, again, I'm leaning on you as the new Earth 2 guy, the boxing gloves. I always think of that as a HAL construct. Do we know? And if you don't know, that's okay. I know I'm putting you on the spot. Do you know if Alan was known for doing boxing gloves? I don't really know.
I don't know, but okay. I don't know that specific stat, but how many times Alan has used a boxing glove. But I don't really, like you, Alan Scott, boxing glove, I don't put those together.
Yeah, exactly.
Ted Grant, yes. Johnny Thunder, yes. You know, both heavyweight champions.
Exactly. Johnny, famously a heavyweight champion. So folks, I'm sure someone at home knows. So please let us know in the comments, because I would be interested to know. Now, there's an interesting scene on page 11, and it's the news crew. It's the GBC news crew. They're down on the street level. They're filming the fight. They're so excited. They're like, oh my gosh, this is what TV's made for. And there's this young guy who's in a sweater and a bow tie and glasses, and he's the young kid named Johnny. And they tell him to go share some information, and then he pulls out a dollar out of his pocket and says, oh, get us some coffee and donuts. It looks like it could be a long night. Now, the script, if you just read the script, it's fine. But if you look at the script in context with the art, we are obviously supposed to feel really bad for little Johnny here, right? Like, all the emotions are laid out in the art for you. What I'm reading from this is nowhere in the words, but what I'm reading from this art is it's telling me that Johnny wants it to be more than just an errand boy. Like, he wants to be an important part of the news team. But again, it's all in the art. It's not in the script. And it doesn't really go anywhere either. It's just an odd bit of character development that comes from the art. And the storytelling is impeccable, if that's in fact what they're trying to communicate. It just really wowed me.
Yeah, Johnny is really being looked over in the whole issue. If you look a couple pages before on page 9, he's the one who notices Black Canary getting kidnapped, and he lets the other guys know, and they're like, stop bothering us, kid, you know?
Yeah. This gorgeous woman in fishnets is being carried away by two men. And yeah, that's not awkward at all.
Yeah. And the one thing that I noticed about him, or when I first saw him and he called him Johnny, I was like, is that Johnny Thunder? Because in those first couple pages where they're not using as much color, you know, if you take away the glasses, he looks pretty much like Johnny Thunder. And it made me wonder if Johnny Thunder was supposed to be working at GBC or something, you know, one of his odd jobs that he had over the years.
I was going to say, he's working there for a day, so... But that's interesting. I wonder if Strzuski was going for Johnny Thunder, we would have got something out of it. But it is interesting that Parabek chose to draw him so much like Johnny Thunder. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those facial expressions, you're talking about what those pages before were amazing. And then like page 12 and 13, where you get Alan's fighting Sagittarius, you get these great facial expressions on, especially like page 13. Sagittarius has this look of shock when Alan cuts his bowstring, or the newsman is so happy when there's all this violence and glass shattering and everything. It's just, wow, Parabek is a master at facial expressions. He's so stinking good. I mean, I had a podcast I ran for years called the Justice League International Blahaha Podcast, where I sang the praises of Kevin Maguire as a facial expression artist. But man, Parabek's up there as one of the best as well.
Yeah, he really tells the story in all of these facial expressions. And on the bottom of page 13 is one of my favorite panels. That is such a great, great expression on that man's face.
Which is ironic because, I mean, first of all, he's a newsman. He's happy about the violence a lot, but it's literally raining shattered glass all over his head. And he's like, yay! Until he gets a big piece in his carotid artery or something.
Yeah, right.
So then we got to talk about Vandal Savage here. So we get to Vandal Savage. He's watching the situation play out on his TV. Sorry, to be correct, on his third TV, because he destroyed two TVs in issue number 1 and 2. And now he's on his third TV, and you actually see the smoldering ruins of the previous TVs, which are pretty funny. And at this point, it's sort of ludicrous, but the Vandal Savage identity still has not been 100% revealed. I mean, he's admitted to being immortal. You can see his black hair and beard. He talks about working with the Nazis and having fought the JSA. As I said in the earlier episodes, it was all over the promotional material. They just told you right from jump who the bad guy was. So I can't imagine there was anyone out there at this point who had not figured out from the context clues or the promotions that this was Vandal Savage. It had to. Everyone had to know, I would think.
I feel like if you were a JSA fan at the time and you saw these images in this issue, you'd pretty much know it's Vandal Savage.
Yeah. Now, all right, so as I say this, now I'm going to talk out the other side of my mouth for a second. So Vandal Savage fought the JSA, obviously, in the 40s. Then he came back one time to fight the Super Squad. Now, this is where my memory gets super fuzzy. Did Vandal Savage come back in Infinity Inc. and All-Star Squadron? I mean, I'm sure he must have, but I'm just not remembering right now. Because if he didn't, I mean, somebody's writing a paragraph right now telling me about some story that I forgot. Because if he didn't come back, this would be the first time that he had been associated with the JSA since the 70s, which would have been, well, mid-70s, let's say. So it's like 15 years or so? Interesting. I don't know.
When you're saying this, all I'm thinking of is Ultra Humanite.
Right, me too!
Appearances.
Every story, I'm like, oh, he was in the stream story. No, that's Ultra Humanite. Wait a minute. You know, it's exactly what's going through my head, too. So, I don't know. All right, well, again, someone at home. This, by the way, folks, this is the danger of doing a podcast. You're recording, you're talking off the top of your head, on the fly, and not fact-checking anything. And that's one of the dangers here. And so you folks at home have the luxury of going, wait a minute, he's not right, and looking it up on Google and telling me I'm wrong, which, by the way, I appreciate being told I'm wrong, so that's fine.
Yes, if I was not on the podcast right now, I'd be jumping to DC Universe Infinite to scroll through comic covers to be like, oh, that is the one I was thinking of.
Exactly. Let's see. Okay, so the Sagittarius transforms into an eagle, and I had to look that one up, so I'm like, well, what's the connection? Well, it turns out that the actual Sagittarius constellation does border another constellation called Aquila, I guess is how you say it, which is in the Eagle constellation. So I guess that's sort of the connection there. It makes sense. I mean, the first one turned into a dog. So the constellations keep transforming. So I get it. That works.
Yeah.
Then, all right, so let's talk about this TV director guy. So we both talked about the panels we love. We talked about, you know, just how awesome he's drawn and everything. Is he a jerk? Because, I mean, we said that he gave that money to little Johnny to go get, to go get them coffee and donuts, but he wasn't mean about it. I mean, he paid for it. So, like, do we think the TV director is a jerk, or is he just a really motivated newsman?
I would lean on jerk, but doesn't know it.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, he's an insensitive guy. He's not picking up that Johnny's trying to work his way up or help out. He's dismissing him when he's like, hey, there's a woman back there that is being attacked by a Frankenstein monster.
I would say also there's another panel which is sort of revealing. I just came across just now where when the wind blows over the camera and the cameraman falls over and everything, he has a fit. He does throw down a bunch of papers. He's like, Murrow gets good crews and I get stuck with weak sisters. I give up. So I guess he is being pretty much a jerk. So yeah, you're probably right. He's a jerk and he doesn't know it. That's fair. All right. So let's talk some art here. Paraback, on page 19, we're getting towards the end of the story. A couple different things. We get a great shot of the eagle that looks super cartoony in the cage, which I love. You get Solomon Grundy, I can only assume pacing, because he's drawn with almost like the Flash gets drawn. He's drawn with speed lines almost. And I think he's just running in circles, pacing, because he's so frustrated, like an animal who's trapped or something, because he sees Green Lantern floating above him and he can't do anything about it.
Yeah, and he has that dot pattern on him.
Yeah, like zip tone or something. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then the last page, something to me went wrong in the last page. I don't know what it is. Solomon Grundy doesn't look like Solomon Grundy. A lot of the art gets a lot less defined. It almost makes me wonder if someone else inked this last page. It doesn't look like Paraback and Burkett together.
You're right. It doesn't. I was wondering the same thing, especially that top panel with Solomon Grundy and his eyes, and even the second panel there on the left-hand side. It's very loosely done, and it makes me wonder if Paraback quickly laid this out but didn't do it in full detail like he did the other pages. So the inker had a much heavier lift and you got something more in his style.
I would agree with that totally, except for the fact that Rick Burchett is the inker. And we saw on issue one, he actually, I believe, penciled and inked his own work on issue number one, and it was exceptional. So I don't think this is Burchett inking this. I think because this doesn't look like Burchett's work. It doesn't look like, again, I think you're right. I think it's more like, what do you call it? Breakdowns or something that by Paraback and then somebody else. Cause it just looks off. It's, which is disappointing because that's the last page of the issue. Right. So a little sad.
Right. Yeah. And breakdowns. Yeah. Like that's what Keith Giffen did on all the 52 books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So last page was standing. So let's forget that one for a second. How do you feel Paraback's art here compares to that 1992 series that we covered previously? How do you feel like the comparing the two?
You know, in some ways, I like it better.
Really?
Because I think it fits the time period so well. There's something about the 90s series, the ongoing, that I think it's beautiful and I love it. But I also feel like it gave a cartoony style in a time where it wasn't, having cartoony books wasn't very cool.
Yeah.
And that's what made it cool, in hindsight. But I think it also took it out of feeling like a modern comic book.
I can see that. You're right. Yeah. Because it had that very, I think you used the term Art Deco earlier, the Art Deco sort of feel. And it does feel very 1940s, that style that Parabek had, especially in the 1982 series. And it was more stylized. Because like here, I think he's still developing. Because this is a year beforehand. I think he continues to develop. By the time he gets to 1992, he's really developed his style, which eventually really dovetails nicely with the Timverse of Batman stuff. But here, I think we get a little more dynamic superhero action. I think we get a little bit of more detail, less stylized. And you're right, it does work for the 40s. So I think I may agree with you. I think his style does fit better here. Could be. Interesting. Hadn't thought about that. And then about this, I want to say one thing about Len Strzoski, and as the writer, I really like that we're into our third issue now, and he's focused on settings that, from a 1991 perspective, the settings feel very classic. They don't feel modern. Like, you've got a giant river dam. You've got this museum with Egyptian artifacts. You've got this old school sort of downtown TV transmitter. These all feel like classic settings and works perfectly for the 1940s. They don't feel like things that would have happened in the 1990s. So I like that he did that and sort of picked locations that feel more classic.
I totally agree. And I love the little details that we get in the artwork, like those three TV screens, how they were stylized back then.
Mm-hmm.
All the old looking electronics, like the camera that they're lugging around.
Exactly. And the phone booth and the old telephone, all of it. Yeah.
Yes.
It feels authentic and it looks great. So overall, it sounds like we both really like the issue. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. I would say so.
Yeah. Very satisfied with this one. I think I'm not going to pick favorites. I think issue 2 is really exceptional with the fight. And also, I didn't realize until this moment, there's no Constellation bad guy in issue number 2, really, because it's really just Black Canary fighting Solomon Grundy. But I'm really digging all this. I think it's coming together really nicely.
Yeah. And again, I loved how this overlaid on issue 2.
Yeah.
And how they take place at the same time.
I'm glad you pointed that out, because I totally wasn't getting that. So now, if you've got the physical copy here, you're looking here, this is our first letter column with actual letters from readers. The previous two, we got like stories and history of the JSA. However, editor Mike Gold, he didn't have time to mail out photocopied previews of the book like he normally would. So this time he was pressed for time. And instead, this is kind of funny, he reached out to this new online forum on something called CompuServe. So, all right, folks, everyone get your giggles out. Yes, CompuServe was still a cutting edge thing in 1991. And the editor found some folks on their comics forum on CompuServe and sent those people copies so that he could quickly get letters back from them. Which, it's sort of funny to me reading Mike Gold describe all this, because it's 1991. And he actually has to explain to the reader what CompuServe even is. He has to explain that it's a, quote, computer service. And then he actually refers to the word online, and he has to put that in quotes too, which clearly means he doesn't expect anyone to know what that word even means. And
that's so funny.
It's hilarious. And then he compares this online fandom of the CompuServe message board. He says they're like old fanzines. He describes them as excited about comics and civil to one another and respectful of different opinions. Man, that is adorable. Just give the internet a few more years, Mr. Gold, and I think you'll see a whole different side of it.
Oh, wow. Ugh.
Could you imagine an age? I don't remember an age where the internet was kind. So,
yeah, that reminds me of when I was listening to an interview with Brian Michael Bendis of when he took over the X-Men books. Mm-hmm. And the X-Men, he had, the original X-Men come into the present, which would be their future. And they were like, what did we do? We thought we were going to win. And this is what it looks like, And that's what that reminds me of. Oh, yeah. Online. This is a great place and everyone gets along. What Obi-Wan, did we do?
Obi-Wan Kenobi was right. There was never a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. So, all right. Well, folks, it is now time for us to nominate the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something that made us laugh, whatever it might be. Both myself and Dave will pick one moment each to spotlight, and both of those moments will earn All-Star Awards. Dave, you're the guest, so why don't you go first?
All right. I am going to pick page 10, where we've got a beautiful cityscape and Alan Scott punching Sagittarius with a boxing glove. Though I don't connect the punching glove with Alan Scott, it's a beautiful image, and I feel like it delivers on what the cover was also selling. And great, great scene, beautiful cityscape, and it was really what this issue is all about.
I'm totally there with you. I actually had two picks just in case. One is a backup because I figured you were going to pick one of my two, and you did. You picked one of them, so that's great. And now looking at this page, and you can see it, guys, on the gallery, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You know, what's happening is directly across from the GBC building, Alan has now socked the Sagittarius, and Sagittarius is falling backwards and smashing through a building. And I'm realizing, in reality, could this just be Alan doing some demolition work to move that skyscraper out of his view of his... Because you know he's in the penthouse, right, at WGB or GBC. And that building's probably blocking his view of another spectacular something. And so he's just, you know, taking out a competitor building. That may be what it is also.
Classic jerk move. Classic jerk move.
It's a beautiful image, though. You're absolutely right. So since you picked that one, I will pick my backup, which was on page 5, Alan transforming into Green Lantern. You know, you get him going into his office, you get the oath, you get the Green Lantern transformation, and so that'll be my pick. Both of them are great scenes. Just absolutely gorgeous pieces by Parabek and Burkett.
Oh, yeah. That was my backup.
There we go. Okay. Well, congratulations to both those scenes. You have won the All-Star Awards, and please wear them with pride. They are as tangible as our love for those moments. Now, Dave, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here in Gotham for a bit? Maybe try to calm down Solomon Grundy, because he is really pissed that he didn't get to kill Green Lantern. Maybe you could cheer him up?
Oh, sure. I've got the perfect nursery rhyme for him. Solomon Grundy, born on a Monday.
Perfect. I'm sure that will go down very successfully. And don't worry, Dave, we will bring you back to the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
To tell you the story of Green Lantern is to tell you the story of the birth of a universe. The origins of DC as a whole.
It's a magic emerald meteor from space in the 1940s.
It's the establishment of the JSA.
It's the birth of the Silver Age.
It's the introduction of a universal police force.
It's the formation of the JLA.
It's the emergence of the multiverse.
It's a crisis in both space and time.
It's an emerald dawn.
And it's an emerald twilight.
It's the brightest day.
And the blackest night.
And the Lantern Cast covers all of this and everything in between. We're Green Lantern's greatest advocates and fiercest critics. We've been fans for years, and it's the reason we're self-proclaimed Lanternologists.
So find us on iTunes and Stitcher and give us a listen, because the history of Green Lantern really is the history of the DC Universe. And we've got the interviews, commentaries, reviews, and more to back it up.
Maybe I can do a podcast about comic books. No, everybody does a podcast about comic books. Maybe I can do a podcast about TV shows. Now, there's a lot of podcasts out there covering TV shows. I know, a podcast about movies. It's too general. A lot of people do podcasts about movies. Star Wars movies. No, everybody talks about Star Wars movies. I need to do a podcast that covers movies and television shows and comics and all the pop culture I loved growing up. Wait a minute. The Pop Culture Basement Podcast, hosted by me, Mike Jamison, covering all the pop culture that I consumed and that we consumed during our formative years. Now available on all reputable podcast platforms. Join us down in the basement.
The Society Pages. The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now remember, folks, as I always say, go out on the social media and find us as JSA Presents, because it is always about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, first up, I do have a request. If you haven't left us an iTunes or Apple Podcast review, please consider it. It really helps to raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. All you got to do is look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. And as a thank you, I will read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air, just like this one. So my thanks go out to, well, honestly, I'm not sure how to say this. It's a lot of letters mixed together. So I'm going to guess that it's RDS Esquire. So if I have that wrong, I apologize. Doing my best here. So they were very kindly wrote, proving the JSA is DC's greatest team. Maybe 90s comics didn't totally suck after all. Having gotten out of comics by the early 90s, this podcast has given me a reason to go back and read the stories covered here. The irredeemable Shag and his guests bring such infectious enthusiasm for these comics. An awesome podcast and well worth listening to. Well, thank you so much again to, I think, RDS Esquire or RDSESQ. So again, really appreciate the review. Again, folks, you can find us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts as Justice Society Presents. And by the way, if you're out of the United States and you happen to leave a review there, please just message me. Otherwise, I won't see the review unless I filter to your specific country. All right, so now let's get into your feedback from last episode, where we did a spotlight discussing Hippolyta as the JSA's Wonder Woman with my guest John Stodd. And I have collected all the comments from our website and what I could find on social media and put it all in a Google document, and it is massively long. I can't read every word, so I'm going to just acknowledge every single person that left a comment on the website and try and read a portion of their comments. So here we go. All right, first up is Gus Casals from the Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and his Legion 60 Years Later podcast. Gus writes, "Hi guys, love the episode because I'm in the team who loved the retcon at the time, and pretty much still. The detail that was missing and that explains away some of your nitpicks is that previous to Diana dying, there was an ongoing subplot with a mystery woman called Polly living a regular life in current times as someone who worked at a restaurant with friends and a rich life. That is, after the whole Artemis affair in the previous run, Hippolyta, as penance, had been living in man's world. That's how she got the Polly nickname and a penchant for short skirts." Wow, Gus, thank you. I had no idea. I just thought that it sort of materialized right there. So that explains so much. It makes a lot more sense. All right. Gus continues and says, "Finally, as much as I love the retcon, as mentioned, my personal headache pet peeve is that it lessens the impact of Diana arriving on man's world the first time. The awe of the public at her is lessened if it's, oh, just like the World War II Wonder Woman. Other than that, I'm all in." Awesome. Well, tell you what, why don't we keep a running tally here of people who are for the retcon and for again. So Gus Casals is our first one. That is one vote for yes for the retcon. All right, up next is Mark Baker Wright from Black Rock's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot. He addresses Gus's comments about the retcon and the whole idea about Diana being her impact being lessened. Mark says, "I hear that, but I don't worry too much about it, especially once we accept the, quote, I didn't remember Polly until just now, but now I remember everything, end quote, way that time travel seems to have worked in the story. This way is much cleaner of a retcon, retaining a great deal of the past history than, say, replacing Wonder Woman with Black Canary or Fury. If a retcon cannot be avoided anyway, I say go for the cleanest one." So there we go. Thank you, Mark. That's one more vote positive for the retcon. All right, then we hear from Brett Miller, who he shared three thoughts. He says, "One, I love the Polly retcon." Right, so that's three for the retcon. And he goes, "Donna Troy is by far my favorite underused character in the DC universe." And then third comment, he says, "You mentioned Sensation Comics number one." Now we're referring to the stuff from the Justice Society Returns storyline in 1999. He says, "Someone tell the editors that having a last name in common with someone doesn't necessarily mean you're related. Speed Saunders and Shiara Saunders, Ted Knight and Sandra Knight, Grant Damage Emerson, and Neil Dr. Polaris Emerson." You make a good point, Brett. I think that trend sort of started with Roy Thomas, but yes, obviously into the 90s, that sort of thing continued quite a bit. All right, up next is Sean Ross from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He has the Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. Sean says, "John Stive is a teacher, a comic fan, and a great podcast guest, and brings in the Perez Wonder Woman trade as a recommendation? Awesome!" Then he goes on to say, "Great episode. While Byrne's run is understandably divisive due to his crazy and needless Wonder Girl Donna Troy retcon, it's an overall a strong run with great moments, Polly being chief amongst them. She's a great character, and this adds a great layer to her narrative. It also gives Diana and Dinah Lance more in common, as both of their moms served in the JSA." All right, that's one more positive vote for the retcon. And you know, Sean, I hadn't thought about the fact that both Diana and Dinah now both have that in common. That's very interesting. All right, then we're here from John Stive, who was the guest on that previous episode. He says, "I'd like to say thank you to anyone who listened to this episode of JSA Presents. I started listening to the Fire and Water Podcast Network many years ago and never thought I'd one day get to be on it. Now, this is Shag, and I gotta say, John, if one of your hopes was to appear on the network, you really need to set your sights higher, buddy. I mean, life's full of all kinds of opportunities. Anyway, John goes on to say, I want to make one correction about something I said. John Byrne was indeed, in my opinion, trying to add to Wonder Woman's rogues gallery during his tenure of the book. But the Clayface thing I mentioned was written by Brian K. Vaughan and happened much later in Diana's run, around issue 160 with the amazing Adam Hughes cover. My apologies for that one, friends. Well, thanks for the correction, John. Then we're here from Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog. Martin says, congratulations to John on his podcast debut. Well, airing-wise at least. He made so many great points, and I look forward to hearing him on Paul's show. I enjoyed the four-issue focus on Hippolyta and the JSA. For one thing, it meant we didn't have to look at the abomination that was John Byrne's interpretation of Diana in the costume. The laziness of the two giant star panties, the ugly belt that rises to cover most of her chest, the Starfire's stupid hair. Happily, he drew Hippolyta a lot nicer. You know, Martin, I hear what you're saying. I totally get it. I see all the things you're pointing out. But you can't change what the heart wants. I love that John Byrne interpretation of Diana. I can't explain it. It just, when I think of Diana, that's the first version I think of. And I know that's wrong, but that's what I think of. So anyway, Martin continues. He says, I like the retcon for all the reasons given. It infantilizes the old queen. You know, Martin, again, I'm going to disagree on this point as well, because if you think about Hippolyta, yes, she's like 1,000 or 2,000 years old. I get that. However, she's still eternally young. So it's not that she is some old crone who needs to act her age. I mean, she has the body of a young person. Why can't she live as a young person? And, you know, and Gus explained how she ended up in that spot. So I don't know. I don't necessarily agree, but I hear what you're saying. I definitely agree with the next point. Martin says, Dark Angel is pants. Plain Paula von Gunter is far more interesting. The idea of thousands of tragic lives for Donna driving Hippolyta insane, how the heck would that work? The whole thing is ridiculously convoluted even for a Donna origin. Incidentally, Dark Angel did later appear in Supergirl and Countdown to Adventure. Oh, thank you for letting us know that. Then Martin says, Wonder Woman with a sword is something I hate. Why would Hippolyta go to Man's World with a massive great blade? She meant to be representing Diana, who went to the U.S. Society with an open heart and an open hand, not one wielding a threatening weapon. Wonder Woman was created with a lasso and bracelets for defense, not a sword for attack. You know, Martin, I can't argue with that. You make great points. And he says, was Hippolyta still the JSA secretary in the revised continuity? The pen is surely mightier than the sword. You know, I don't know, Martin. That's a good question. I don't know if she was still secretary, but there we go. Overall, that's one more vote for the positive for the retcon. All right, up next, we heard from Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcasting Network, including the DC Secret Files and Origins podcast and Diana Prince, the new Wonder Woman blog and podcast. Now, Frank wrote almost 2,000 words. He wrote a lot, and as always, it's well worth reading. I recommend you go out to the website and read it, as always, and all the comments you should go out and read. Honestly, they're so fantastic. So I have just cherry-picked some of Frank's comments here, so brace yourself. It says, no, I wasn't wild for the book by the time John Byrne assigned Hippolyta the lead role, just as I never warmed to her time-traveling shenanigans, making her chronologically the first Wonder Woman. I think we all agree that there should be a World War II Wonder Woman to serve in the JSA, and this has been remained the most palatable means of executing that concept. I have no desire to ever revisit the Byrne era, which in memory has been made only slightly less painful when compared to the even worse Eric Luke period. I bought all these comics, including the extra-length anthologies, so this episode was kind of a nom flashback for me. Wonder Woman drew a blade on special occasions, particularly in the Silver and Bronze Age, but it was Hippolyta that made that a routine thing. Now, I love this whole next thing here. He goes on to say, I mean, after they killed Hippolyta off in Our World of War, and then rebooted continuity in the New 52, Wonder Woman, Diana, stealing an attribute from her subordinate characters and fridging them has always been her way. In the second ever Wonder Woman story, Princess Diana bribes a lookalike nurse named Diana Prince so that she could assume her identity while packing Nurse Prince off to South America. Donna Troy could fly under her own power and was more prone to feats of strength until Wonder Woman assumed those attributes and obliterated Donna's origin. Cassie Sandsmark was a secret demigoddess fathered by Zeus until Diana was the same. The Fury, Donna Troy, and now Wonder Woman all had insta-adult babies who joined them in cosmic conflict and then threaten history or reality. So he wraps up this thought with saying, if you're in the Wonder Woman family and you have something Diana wants, update your will. I love that, Frank. Thank you. Then he shared some more concerns about how Hippolyta retcon. He says, for instance, Toga Hippolyta spending centuries in a low-key but committed lesbian relationship with General Philippus, and then jumping on Wildcat's, we'll just say stuff, as soon as she bounces back into the time stream, quote, I'm mourning my daughter's quasi-death and ascendance into goddesshood alongside noted sexual assaultant Zeus, but it's nothing a little vitamin D can't cure, end quote. Oh, jeez, Frank. And hey, the whole Wonder Woman thing was a solemn role earned through a tournament pitting all the Amazon Klingons against each other as a core tenet of the franchise. Or Queen Mother can just deem it a reverse hereditary role and assume it herself with no other bids taken? You know, that's a good point about the Wonder Woman role. You're right, Diana had to earn it. Hippolyta just took it. Then Frank says, Paula von Gunther has been revisited and revised many times beyond Dark Angel, though all of that chaps my hide, because it reverses her decades-spanning reformation as the Amazon's chief scientist, lasting from the gold through the Bronze Ages. You know, Frank, now that you say that, it's sort of a V8 moment, like slapping my forehead. Of course Paula von Gunther, it was a pre-crisis character, she'd been around since the 40s. I'm kicking myself for not even mentioning that last episode. I didn't even think about that, it didn't even occur to me that was the same character, so thank you for pointing that out. And then he says, I'm with Martin in loathing the sword. It's vulgar for William Moulton Marsden's pacifist, lasso-wielding, benevolent female supremacist to wag a failing tool at her modern foes. Woof. All right. So again, a lot more. You can check it on the website. But I think that's fair to say that Frank is not a positive vote in the camp for the retcon. All right. Moving on. We heard from Jose A. Rivera, author of Underground Adventures. He says, thank goodness for this episode, because whenever the retcon is brought up online, all I see is negativity from people. Some are angry because they don't want Polly to be the first Wonder Woman, while others think it's a spit in the face to Earth too. I've always liked the retcon because it does what post-crisis retcons do best, find a creative way to introduce an old idea in a new way while working within the restrictions of the new continuity. It's funny how the Ultimate Universe did this all the time and got praised for it, while DC did stuff like this and got hate for it. I guess it sucks to be the person to go first and you'll take all the hits. I love that the team calls her Polly from these issues to her time in JSA in the 2000s. Right there with you, Jose, and that is another positive vote. Then we're from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He laid out a whole Elseworlds story you should check out, again, on our website, all about the JSA acting as protectors at one of the later World's Fairs. So be sure to go out to our website and check that out. Then we heard from Super Captain, who says, outside of the Perez-era series, my reading of the Wonder Woman solo titles has been limited. I don't mind the Hippolyta retcon at all. Out of the DC Trinity, Wonder Woman fits into that World War II setting the best, and it'd be a shame to lose a female member of the JSA when they only have so few. It reminded me of a JSA-related Wonder Woman retcon that I did not like. When Wonder Woman was devolved into clay and the Earth 2 history was wiped out at the end of the crisis, that meant Fury from Infinity Inc. was no longer Lyta Trevor, daughter of Diana and Steve Trevor, but the daughter of a brand new character, yet another Fury, who fought with the All-Star Squadron in the 1940s. So much of the appeal of Infinity Inc. for me was the children of the JSA hook, and Fury was less interesting to me as a result. I hadn't thought about that, Super Captain. Just the fact, I mean, I like the idea of her being Fury's kid, because I kind of like the Young All-Stars idea. But you make a good point. They're supposed to be the children of the JSA, not the children of the All-Star Squadron. Good point. And then Super Captain says, also, every time you mention Dark Angel, I think of the Jessica Alba TV series on Fox from the early 2000s. Maybe someone at the network was a fan. Oh, that's good. All right. All right, so that's one more positive vote for the retcon. Then we hear from Alan Williams from Monsters from the Id and Watch This Space podcast. Alan says, I really dislike Byrne's Wonder Woman run. Quote, let's make a convoluted retcon to shove Hippolyta into the Golden Age Wonder Woman, end quote, when Roy Thomas had already plugged in Miss America as the JSA secretary. Like the whole Pocket Universe Superboy story, Byrne's retcon is a very limited substitution. Hippolyta doesn't fill in all the blanks. No Diana Prince, no Steve Treasure, no Etta Candy, and just like introducing the Sands Marks when the Capitella's family was still around. To me, this was just typical Byrne, let's bulldoze over what came before and make things fit the way I want to. A practice that irks me to no end, no matter who does it, because it leaves the continuity landscape littered with detritus and collateral damage. That said, I think you covered the story really well, Shag and John. Kudos. Well, thank you for the compliment, Alan, and I think that's definitely a vote in the negative for the retcon. Appreciate it, Alan. Then we heard from Hal, who says, I noticed several commenters mentioning the clever use of heroes swapping costumes and identities. That bit was already an old trope by then. The book that brought me full-fledged into the DC fold, JLA number 12, the story that introduced the Silver Age Dr. Light, had Superman and Batman switch identities. It'd been done at least a couple times since. Oh, absolutely, Hal. I'm right there with you. And I think John Byrne wasn't trying to make that like the first time kind of thing. I think he was just more, as you're saying, sort of echoing stuff in the past. Then we heard from Joe LaWallen, who says, great episode. Count me as someone who loves the retcon. Love the original issues where Polly goes back in time with the JSA, and the JSA is my favorite DC team. I wish there were more JSA members in the story, as I would have loved seeing his version of Hourman, Dr. Midnight, Sandman, and the Starman. Oh, totally agree, Joe. That would have been amazing to see John Byrne draw those. He goes on to continue, says, the John Byrne Wonder Woman omnibus is fantastic, and there's a surprisingly generous and humble intro by Byrne written in 2024, where he speaks fondly of George Perez, and dedicates the book to Perez. Humble and Byrne Byrne are not usually listed in the same sentence, but it seemed genuine. It's hard to be humble when you are John freaking Byrne. And he says, signs it by saying, JSA fan since Justice League of America, number 171. Hey, Joe, we've got a comic in common. That was my first JSA comic as well. That's awesome. So that's one more vote positive for the retcon. Then we heard from Simon Pierre Desmarais. He says, I love the retcon. I read that Speed Force issue before, and I started collecting Wonder Woman when Polly replaced Diana. I always found the way old Jay reacted to Hawkman a little funny. I know the guy fought Nazi airplanes shirtless with a mace, but I don't think that's enough against the experienced Jay and Polly. You guys did an excellent job, and you said it all, and I don't have anything to add except I love John Byrne as well. Aw, well, thank you, Simon. And that is, again, another vote in favor of the retcon. Then we're from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He hosts the Mr. and Mrs. Superman stories right here on the JSA Presents feed. He also had the JLU cast and much more. Chris says, I liked the Byrne run on Wonder Woman, and I liked the Polly retcon. Yeah, it's timey-wimey that she became Wonder Woman after Diana, but technically precedes her too. But it's comics. I did like what Byrne did with Donna Troy. It was a nice nod to the strange creation of Donna from a misunderstanding of the strange, impossible Wonder Family team-ups between adult, teen, and baby Diana and Polita. All right, Chris, I appreciate that. Hey, that's one more vote in favor of the retcon. Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, I liked these comics when they came out. I was glad they redeemed Hippolyta after the Wonder Woman 1990s run. Her being the Wonder Woman of World War II was cool and keeps that history without upsetting the Perez run. All right, Liz, thank you. And that is another vote in the positive for the retcon. All right, then we heard from Ward Hill Terry from the band Stop Calling Me Frank. He says, I do not believe I have ever enjoyed a story written by John Byrne. I admit my prejudice. Nevertheless, these four issues of Wonder Woman are bad comics. Overall, it's too much backstory, exposition, and very little action. You know, Terry, in that episode, I'm pretty sure I said, even though I enjoyed the comics, I did admit that I wasn't even sure they were good. So I want to be fair. I'm kind of on the same page with you so far. Then Terry goes on to say, the invisible plane needs to be reformatted to fit into the 1940s. The invisible plane? You keep saying this word, but I don't think you know what it means. Terry, that is brilliant. That is absolutely genius. You're right. Why would an invisible plane need to be reformatted to look like something from the 1940s? That is hysterically funny. Never thought of it till this moment. So well played, Terry. He goes on to say, why in the late 1990s were DC writers still trying to patch things over? But we get things like this mess. Retcons like Flash being an active member of the JSA in July 1942 and Green Lantern. They were off the roster by then. In fact, the JSA was essentially disbanded. They were the Justice Battalion. Now, there you go, Terry. You're bringing the knowledge bombs there. I definitely knew that at some point those characters left the team. I definitely knew that they became the Justice Battalion. I didn't realize the time frame and how it lines up with this. So good catch, Terry. He goes on to say, why did or do post-crisis creators feel compelled to stick Wonder Woman in the JSA? If they think that the wartime Justice Society needs a secretary, meaning Wonder Woman's role, Hawkgirl is right there. There is little in the origin stories that Wonder Woman did that Hawkgirl couldn't. All right. Very good feedback, Ward. I appreciate that. Pretty confident that Ward is in the negative for the Polly retcon, and that's perfectly fine. Appreciate that opinion and your perspective, Terry. All right, then we're from Jordan Jennings from Extremely Uncanny and the host of the podcast Neverending Battle. Jordan says, greatly enjoy this episode. I've always liked this retcon as it allowed the Golden Age Wonder Woman stories, but without being a regressive return to Wonder Woman's past a la Geoff Johns approach to Superman's secret origin. I haven't read any of the Byrne's Wonder Woman run, but my first exposure to Hippolyta as Wonder Woman was in the Our Worlds of War event. I read that phone book-sized paperback omnibus without much, if in any, real understanding of Superman or DC Comics at that point in time. Talk about jumping in the deep end. I survived, though it speaks to why I tend to chase out these convoluted events. In the story itself, Polly's death was definitely a heroic moment, but in the sea of character deaths, real and fake outs, it got kind of lost in the noise. Yeah, Jordan, I didn't even remember until I was doing research for that episode that she died in Our Worlds at War. And honestly, pretty much any time in the last 25 years, if a character dies, I barely even remember it because I'm just assuming they're going to come back any day, you know, or whatever. So that's one more positive vote for the retcon. All right, up next is Dave Tomko from the website called New Earth 2. I don't even know if this is a real guy. I've never heard of this guy. He might be AI, for all I know, folks. Anyway, this mystery person, Dave Tomko, says, great episode, guys. I really enjoyed it. Honestly, more than these four issues of the Byrne Wonder Woman, which I found to be a bit of a mixed bag. That said, it gives us a mixed bag retcon that I ultimately come down in favor of. As mentioned in the episode and the comments, the story is all over the place, juggling multiple plot lines. Still, I love seeing the classic JSA, especially Hippolyta, drawn by Byrne. Once it's all said and done, though, the retcon serves JSA-centric stories very well. The initial, oh, now I remember, effect for the characters is fun, but that only works once. After that, you're left with a change that somehow undercuts the impact of Diana's arrival in Man's World. It's similar to reinstating public knowledge of Superboy before Superman. Many of the big reveals happen earlier, which lessens the impact of Superman's debut. For both Superboy and Hippolyta, I tend to think of their histories as more like urban legends, things the public does not fully know or believe, which helps preserve the significance of Superman and Diana's origin. Robot Dave, I gotta agree, I'm not in favor of them making Superboy, the retcon, bringing all that back. I like the way it worked out in Man of Steel, where Superman became Superman as an adult, and big splash appearance. I understand there's a lot of love for Superboy, and Mark Waid's telling some great stories. I mean, they're really enjoyable to read. I'm just not a fan of that idea of Superboy being out there. So, and I guess that maybe that makes me hypocritical, since I'm okay with the Hippolyta thing, but not Superboy. I don't know. Yeah, the heart wants what the heart wants, as I always say. All right, AI Dave continues. No retcon is perfect, but this might be the cleanest and simplest way to reintroduce a World War II Wonder Woman post-crisis. And yes, new history of the DC Universe and JSA Year One both confirm that Polly is back as Wonder Woman in World War II. If I remember correctly, this was undone at some point during Dan DiDio's tenure, and then they were seeds planted for Diana to be the World War II Wonder Woman as part of the planned 5G event. Either way, I'm glad Polly is back in that role. Yeah, and that's what I was kind of thinking. I was thinking that at some point they had undone it and, you know, tied it more to, like, the movie continuity where Diana had just been alive for a long time. And then it goes on to say about the JSA Year One story, Hippolyta definitely meets the JSA differently than in Byrne's version, but it still includes her tossing around Al Pratt. When I reread that moment in Byrne's issues, it made me wonder if Jeff Lemire was giving a subtle wink and nod to Byrne's book with his Polly and Pratt dynamic. Ah, that's great. I love that. Well, thank you, Dave Tomko, whoever you are. And that's one more vote in favor of the retcon. Then we're from Nate the Great. Says, I think Hippolyta was closer to the Gal Gadot version of Wonder Woman than Perez or Linda Carter. Still, the main draw here is Byrne drawing the JSA. However, this version of Dark Angel is not as good as the Jessica Alba version. Professor Alan Quarterbin from the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network said, excellent conversation. Well, thank you, Professor. And Comic Foil said, after listening to the episode earlier in the week, I am inspired to pull the 4 Wonder Woman issues and Speed Force one-shot out of the long boxes for a reread this weekend. Awesome, Comic Foil. I hope you enjoyed them. Then we heard from Tom Potter, who says, another great episode. As a longtime JSA fan and collector, I always look forward to the show, but especially enjoy the spotlight episodes to fill in gaps in stories I may have missed. I do remember enjoying this retcon. It was cleaner than some of the proxies and reestablishes all those original Wonder Woman stories back into continuity. I don't even mind the Polly nickname, since she's the queen back on the island, but just Polly to her work friends. Oh, okay, that's a good way to look at it. Then Tom continues, Polly is still the JSA's Wonder Woman in the current Year One story, but this time it doesn't look like there's a time travel element. And then he proposes, and I'm not going to read all this because it's a little lengthy, but he proposes this idea of what if Polly wasn't the first Wonder Woman at all, and suggests how there could be this long-standing sort of tradition of the Wonder Woman mantle being passed down, which is kind of an interesting idea. So maybe that's something that they could establish someday. So that's one more positive vote for the retcon. All right, then we heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters Under Siege and Avengers podcast. Tim says, this episode gave me an excuse to at least check out these issues. First impression is Byrne is full-on burning. All of his writing tics are in full force, not enough to be a turnoff, but enough to trip me up sometimes, like the heavy explained panels, overly complex subplots, and weird dialogue choices like Jay saying, quote, she likes to be called Polly, instead of her saying it for herself. By the way, now that you mentioned that, Tim, I meant to mention one of Byrne's weird things in this issue, and I forgot. The way he lettered that book is crazy. Like, there's so much text, and the word balloons are so skinny, it just makes for a weird read with the word balloons. Anyway, getting back into Tim's comments. It says, now that I've read these and seen Themyscira exists anywhere in time, boy, that jumps out as a dangerous get-out-of-jail-free plot element that could be seriously abused by future writers. And there's really no limitation on doing it except for the Amazon saying they really, really shouldn't do that. But okay, just this once. And just this once. And maybe this time. And maybe now because breakfast wasn't really so good and let's do it all over again. I have to think that hasn't been the case, but it's not a good precedent. Yeah, I mean, I'm a lifelong fan of Doctor Who, but even I recognize time travel can be a very slippery slope with storytelling techniques. Then Tim says, was it fun to see Byrne draw the original JSA? Heck yeah! Do I like Polly as a JSA member? Again, heck yeah! I haven't read much of those stories, but that story with Liberty Bell, Phantom Lady, and Red Tornado is glorious and lives rent-free in my head. The concept has plenty of potential and could be mined for more, like in the current JSA Year One arc, so I'm all for it. So this has been a net positive for me. All right, Tim, thank you so much, and that is another positive vote for the retcon. I did tally all this up, we've been talking, so the final count from all these comments, and by the way, I realize this is not even remotely scientific. I mean, first of all, it's just people who chose to come on the website. It's just people who happen to listen to this show. If they're already listening to a show called JSA in the 90s, more than likely they're predisposed to liking the Polly retcon anyway. But just doing this sort of little, you know, check-in, we had 15 comments in favor of the retcon and only 3 opposed. So there we go. All right. Also want to say thank you to a couple of folks who mentioned our show on their website. So thank you so much to Anthony Cardino, who shared on his blog about the JSA in the 90s podcast. Thank you so much. And then a website called New Earth 2 by, again, this strange person I've never heard of named Dave Tomko. All right. Now, this is my chance to thank everybody who shared our show in their social media timeline. So this is Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter, or Threads. It is a long list of names. I realize that. However, these folks shared their support and promoted the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. And this time out, we've got nearly 70 people who helped promote the last episode of the show. Now, here is where I got a bit of a sticking point. It's actually more than that, but I don't know, because both Facebook and Instagram are being royal pains right now. For Instagram, it is very difficult to see who all reshared the show. I'm able to sort of piece it together. Facebook, just in the last couple of weeks, has suddenly decided not to tell us who's been sharing the show. We can see, like, a share, you know, a post has been shared 10 times or something, but it doesn't tell us who anymore unless we pull it just from the notifications, and that's not very reliable. So, I apologize. If you shared this on Facebook and Instagram and I missed you, please just let me know. Drop me a note and let me know. I'll be sure to include you on the next episode. And I'm going to endeavor to try and collect this information from the notifications until Facebook hopefully changes this process. That's a lot of information just to say, I'm sorry if I missed you. All right, and you could be on this list next month. It's very easy just by sharing or retweeting or reskeeting or whatever it's called on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. So our thanks go out to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Alan Boyce Jr., Andre Friitis, Bailey Planet, Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages Blog, Black Vulcan 69, Brad Dade, Brainy Ashtray, Brian Schufo, Buddy 7220273, Chelsea Daniel, Chris Retz, Chuck Krieger Loridens, 004 Clinton, Comic Foil, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, Dave Steele, DC Newer 2, Dee Dee at D Comic Talks, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Ed Moore, Extremely Uncanny, Fan Film Fridays Podcast, Grumpy Old John, Herbie Herb, J. David Weeder, James A. Sisena, John Stibe, Joe V. Cast, J.P. Roca, Julia Rowell, Justin Steiner, Keechee Baker, Con L, Longbox Review, Magazines and Monsters, Market MDB 1958, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Max Romero, Michael Bailey, Mike Jameson, Mike Thomas, Mo Walker, Monitor Earth Prime, Outcasters, Under Siege, and Avengers Podcast, Peace Bounded Down, a Wonder Woman Podcast, Pop Culture Basement, Quatari Ninja Warrior, Relatively Geeky Podcast, Robert Junker, Sam Lowe, Scott X, Silverman on Security, Skiz at Gigantopithecus, Slangword Scott, S. Matthew Stolte, Sparking Drill, Stephen E. Shend, The Earth 2 Podcast, Tim Price, Uncle Bruno's Customs, Venkman, and Zek Cap Boots. Wow. My thanks to all of you and the folks I missed for your support of the JSA podcast. Your feedback was such a critical part of the show and this community of JSA fans we have built together. You guys are honestly the best. Now, again, if I've missed or forgotten anyone, I'm really sorry. It's probably the fault of John Stibe or maybe Facebook and Instagram. Either way, I really do my best to find all your social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my fingers. So please just let me know. And again, I will mention you on the next episode. And keep those cards and letters coming. Visit our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post, and fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts and you guys can communicate together. And you can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter, and Threads, or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. My thanks again to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Dave Tomko, and we'll see how he managed with Solomon Grundy.
Across the DC multiverse, countless worlds exist in parallel, each with its own history, its own heroes, its own destiny. But before you can visit the worlds, you have to understand the map. I'm DC Dave, and this is Infinite Earths, a guide to the DC multiverse. In Season 1, we explore the architecture of the multiverse itself, the shifting cosmic designs that have defined DC history for decades. From the earliest experiments in parallel Earths to the sweeping restructurings that reshaped reality, we trace how the multiverse was built, broken, and rebuilt again. This is your field guide to the foundations of infinite possibility. The orrery is waiting. Let's explore.
Have you ever been reading through a stack of comics and thought, maybe I should see what that Arkham Asylum game is all about? Or been playing Marvel vs. Capcom and felt like you were at a real disadvantage since you didn't know who half the characters were? Well, Play Comics is the show for you. I'm Chris, and each episode we take a look at video games based on comic properties and how well they stick to that source material. So whether you know the comics and want to know how all those games work, or you know the games and want to find out where all this craziness came from, go check out Play Comics at playcomics.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got Dave back with us. First of all, Dave, thank you so much for appearing on this episode. It's been an absolute blast chatting with you. You've been very kind in your comments over the last year, just leaving really thoughtful insight on these episodes that we've been covering, and it's always been appreciated, and now I'm so happy we had this chance to chat. So why don't you tell the folks at home where they can find more of you on the interwebs?
Sure. You can find me at newearth2.com, where I post the latest news and my opinions on the JSA, Earth 2, and Golden Age characters and their legacies. You could also find me on Threads at DC New Earth 2 and on Blue Sky at newearth2.bsky.social.
Well, folks, if you haven't checked out the new Earth 2 website, you really need to. It's got a ton of fascinating information. And I know you're a JSA fan already because you're listening to the show. So you're going to love everything you find there. Again, Dave, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, that's going to do it, folks. Now come back next episode when we present a very special spotlight episode on a specific JSA character. I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Oh, what the heck. I'll go ahead and tell you since you hung around this long. Next episode will be an amazing spotlight on the 1999 miniseries entitled Dr. Midnight. And my special guests, yes, plural, will be none other than, wait for it, the writer and the artist of the miniseries, Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III. Yes, you heard that right. We are doing an interview with the actual creators to cover the Dr. Midnight miniseries. I've already recorded the interview with Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III, and it was fantastic. I cannot wait for you to hear this incredible discussion next month. Okay, well, thanks for listening, folks. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Dave.
And we're asking you to join the fight
for justice.